that loss, to blind us to potential solutions. Simon knew them, Merlin, Martha said, her tone flat. He knew them better than any of us, and they killed him. Do you really think they will be inclined to see a reasonable peace with us, when they've already destroyed the wizard best able to protect himself against them? Why should they seek peace, Merlin? They're winning. The Merlin waved a hand. Your anger clouds your judgment. They will seek a peace because, even in victory, they would pay too high a cost. Don't be a fool, Martha said. They will never sue for peace. In point of fact, said the Merlin, they already have. He gestured to a second podium on his left. Wizard Lafortier. Lafortier was an emaciated man of medium height and build. His cheekbones stood out grotesquely from his sunken face, and his bulging eyes looked a couple of sizes too large. He had no hair at all, not even eyebrows, and on the whole it gave him a skeletal look. When he spoke, his voice came out in a resonant basso, deep and warm and smooth. Thank you, Merlin. He held up an envelope in one thin-fingered hand. I have a missive here from Duke Ortega, a ward leader of the Red Court, received this morning. In it he details the Red Court's motivations in this matter and the terms they desire for peace. He also offers, by token of goodwill, a temporary cessation of hostilities in order to give the Council time to consider, effective this morning.
Bullshit!
The word burst out of my mouth before my brain realized I'd said it. A round of snickers, mostly from the brown-robed apprentices, echoed through the theater, and I heard fabric rustle as every wizard in the place turned to look at me. I felt my face heat again and cleared my throat.
Well, it is,
I said to the room. Ebenezer translated for me.
I was attacked by a Red Court hit squad only a few hours ago.
Lafortier smiled at me and stretched his lips out to show his teeth, like the dried face of a thousand-year-old mummy. Even if you're not lying, Wizard Dresden, I would hardly expect perfect control of all Red Court forces, given your role in precipitating this war.
Precipitating it? I exclaimed. Do you have any idea what they did?
Lafortier shrugged. They have defended an assault upon their sovereignty, Wizard. You, acting in the role of representative of this council, attacked a noble of their court, damaged her property, and killed members of said noble's household and her as well. In addition, the records of local newspapers and authorities reveal that during the altercation, several young men and women were also killed, burned up in a fire, I think. Does that sound familiar to you, Wizard Dresden? I clenched my jaw, the sudden rush of rage spilling through me in such a torrent that I could scarcely see, much less trust myself to speak. I'd been brought before the council for the first time when I'd been put on trial for violating the first law of magic, thou shalt not kill. I'd burned my old mentor, Justin, to death. When I'd clashed with Bianca, lately of the Red Court, the previous year, I'd called up a firestorm when it looked as if my companions and I were going to buy it anyway. A lot of vampires burned. The bodies of some people had been found afterward, too. There was no way to tell which of them had been victims of the vampires, and already dead when the fire got to them, and which, if any, had been alive before I came along. I still have nightmares about it. I'm a lot of things, but I'm not a willing murderer. To my shock, I felt myself gathering in power, getting ready to unleash it at Lafortier with his skeletal smirk. Ebenezer caught my eye, his own a little wide, and shook his head quickly. I clenched my hands into tight fists instead of blasting anybody with magic and forced myself to sit down again before I spoke. Self-disciplined, that's me. I have already detailed my recollection of the events in my report to the council. I stand by them. Anyone who tells you differently than what you read there is lying. Lafortier rolled his eyes. How comfortable it must be to live in such a clear-cut world, Wizard Dresden. But we are not counting the cost of your action in coins or hours wasted. We are counting it in blood. Wizards are dying because of what you did while acting in this council's name. Lafortier swept his gaze to the rest of the theater, his expression stern, controlled. Frankly, I think it may be wise for the council to consider that we may indeed stand in the wrong in this matter, and that it might be prudent to give careful consideration to the Red Court's terms for peace.
"What do they want?"
I snarled at the man. Ebenezer provided the Latin for the rest of the council. "A pint of blood a month from each of us? Rights to hunt freely whenever they choose? Amulets to shield them from the light of the sun?"
Lafortier smiled at me and folded his hands atop the podium.
"Nothing so dramatic, Dresden. They simply want what any of us would want in this situation. They want justice." He leaned toward me, bulging eyes glittering. "They want you."
Chapter 6. Gulp.
"Me?" I said.
"Et la, Fortier. Feel the bite of my rip, your wit."
"Yes. Duke Ortega writes that you, Wizard Dresden, are considered a criminal by the Red Court. In order to end this conflict, they wish to extradite you to an area of their designation for trial. A resolution that is perhaps distasteful, but may also be only just."
He didn't get the last word out of his mouth before several dozen wizards around the auditorium rose to their feet with outraged shouts. Others stood up to cry out against them, and still more against them. The room descended into a cacophony of shouts, threats, and cussing. Among wizards, cursing is a different matter altogether, in dozens of languages. The Merlin let people shout for a moment before he called out in a ringing voice, "Order!" No one paid him any attention. He tried once more, then lifted his staff and slammed it down hard on the stage beside him. There was a flash of light, a roar of sound, and a concussion that slopped the water in my glass over the brim, spilling it on my flannel bathrobe. A couple of the wispier wizards were knocked down by the force of it, but in any case, the shouting ceased.
"Order!"
the Merlin demanded again, in exactly the same tone. "I am well aware of the implications of this situation, but lives are at stake, your lives and my own. We must consider our options with the utmost gravity."
"What options?" Ebenezer demanded. "We are wizards, not a herd of frightened sheep. Will we give one of our own to the vampires now and pretend that none of this has happened?"
Fortier snapped. "You read Dresden's report. By his own admission, what the Red Court accuses him of is true. They have a just grievance."
"The situation was clearly manipulation. A scheme to force Dresden to those actions in hopes of killing him."
"Then he should have been smarter," Lafortier said in a flat tone. "Politics is not a game for children. Dresden played and was beaten. It is time for him to pay the price so that the rest of us may live in peace."
Injun Joe put a hand on Ebenezer's arm and spoke quietly. "Peace cannot be bought, Alaron," he murmured to Lafortier. "History teaches that lesson. I learned it. You should have, too." Lafortier sneered at Injun Joe. "I don't know what you're babbling about, but..." I rolled my eyes and stood up again.
"He's talking about the American tribes losing their land to white settlers. Dolt." I figured Ebenezer would leave the insult out of the translation, but there were more stifled snorts from brown robes around the room. "And about Europe's attempts to appease Hitler before the Second World War. Both attempted to purchase peace with compromise, and both got swallowed up bit by bit."
The Merlin glared at me. "I did not recognize you, Wizard Dresden. Until you have the floor, you will refrain from such outbursts, or I will have you removed from this meeting." I clenched my jaw and sat down.
Sorry. Here I was, figuring we had a responsibility to protect people. What was I thinking?
"We will protect no one, Wizard Dresden, if we are all dead," the Merlin snapped. "Be silent or be removed."
Martha Liberty shook her head. "Merlin, it seems clear that we cannot simply hand one of our own over to the Red Court because of their demands. Despite past differences with the council policy, Dresden is a fully ranked wizard, and given his performance in recent years, he seems well deserving of the title."
"I am not questioning his ability with the art," Lafortier put in. "I question his judgment, his choices. He has played loose and reckless with his status as a wizard since Justin's death.
The bald man turned his bulging eyes to the wizards in the theater. Wizard Harry Dresden, apprentice to the wizard Justin Dumorne, apprentice to the wizard Simon Petrovich. I wonder how the Red Court learned enough of Petrovich's defenses to bypass them so completely, Dresden. I stared at Lafortier for a second, shocked. Did the man actually believe that I had learned about this Petrovich's defenses through Justin, then sold a senior member of the White Council to the vampires? Justin hadn't exactly taken me around much. Before I'd been put on trial, I hadn't even known that there was a White Council, or other wizards at all, for that matter. I gave him the only answer I could. I laughed at him. Wheezy, quiet laughter. I shook my head. Lafortier's expression grew outraged. "You see," he demanded to the room, "you see in what contempt he holds this council? His position as a wizard? Dresden has constantly endangered us all with his obtuse indiscretion, his reckless disregard for secrecy and security. Even if it was someone else who betrayed Petrovich and his students to the Red Court, Dresden is as guilty of their murder as if he himself had cut their throats. Let the consequences of his decision fall upon him." I rose and faced Lafortier, but glanced at the Merlin for permission to speak. He gave the floor to me with a grudging nod. "Impossible," I said. "Or at least impractical. I have violated none of the laws of magic in this matter, which rules out a summary trial. I am a full wizard. By council law, I am therefore entitled to an in-depth investigation and trial, neither of which would provide any kind of workable solution anytime soon." The room rumbled with agreement when Ebenezer finished translating for me. That was hardly a surprise. If the council jammed a trial down my throat and then threw me to the wolves, it would set a deadly precedent, one that could haunt any wizard in the room, and they knew it. Lafortier jabbed a forefinger at me and said, "Quite true, provided that you are, in fact, a full wizard. I move that the council vote immediately to determine whether or not Dresden's status as wizard is valid. I remind the council that his appointment to this stole was a de facto decision based upon circumstantial evidence. He has never stood trial, never been judged worthy by his peers." "Like hell I haven't," I assured him. "I beat Justin Dumorne in a duel to the death. Is that not trial enough for you?"
"Wizard Dumorne died, yes," Lafortier said. "Whether he was defeated in an open duel or burned in his sleep is another matter entirely. Merlin, you have heard my motion. Let the council vote upon the status of this madman. Let us end this foolishness and return to our lives." Ouch. An angle I hadn't thought of. If I was stripped of my stole, it would be like a medieval noble having his title taken away. I would no longer be a wizard, politically speaking, and according to council law and to the accords between the various supernatural factions, the council would be obliged to turn over a fugitive murderer to the Red Court. Which would mean, if I was fortunate, a horrible death. If I wasn't fortunate, it could be considerably worse. Given the kind of day I'd been having, my heart started skittering in my chest. The Merlin frowned and nodded.
"Very well, then. We vote upon the issue of the status of one Harry Dresden. Let those who would have him keep his stole vote for, and those in favor of his status being restored to that of apprentice vote against. All those in
Wait, Ebenezer interjected. "I invoke my right as a member of the senior council to reduce the vote to the senior council alone."
The Merlin glared at Ebenezer.
"On what grounds?" "On the grounds that there exists a great deal of information about this matter, of which the council, at large, is unaware. It would be impractical to attempt to explain it all."
"Seconded," Injun Joe murmured.
"Accord," Martha Liberty added. "Three votes yea, honored Merlin. Let the senior council make this decision."
My heart started beating again. Ebenezer had made the right call. In a room full of frightened men and women, I wouldn't have had a prayer of keeping my stole. With the vote reduced to the senior council, maybe I had a fighting chance. I could almost see the Merlin trying to figure a way out of it, but council law is pretty clear on that point. The senior council members can always take a matter to a close vote with three supporters.
Very well, the Merlin said. The room rustled with whispers. My interests lie in preserving the health and safety of those upon this council and of the communities of mankind in general. I vote against Dresden's validity as an initiate wizard of this council.
The Fortier jumped in, bulging eyes narrowed.
As do I, for the same reasons.
Ebenezer spoke next.
I have lived with this young man. I know him. He's a wizard. I vote to preserve his status.
Little Brother chittered from his perch on Injun Joe's shoulder, and the old wizard stroked the raccoon's tail with one hand. My instincts about this man tells me that he comports himself as a wizard should. He gave a very mild glance to Lafortier. I vote in favor of his status.
As do I, Martha Liberty added. This is not a solution. It is merely an action.
Harry three, bad guys two. I turned my eyes to ancient Mai. The tiny woman stood with her eyes closed for a moment, her head bowed. Then she murmured,
No wizard should so blatantly misuse his status as a member of this council. Nor should he be as irresponsible as Harry Dresden has been with his use of the art. I vote against his retention of wizard status.
3-3. I licked my lips and realized at just that moment that I had been too nervous and involved with events to take note of the seventh member of the senior council. He was standing at the far left of the stage. Like the other wizards, he wore a black robe, but his dark purple, almost black stole had a deep cowl upon it as well, which covered his face entirely. The candlelit dimness masked in shadow whatever the cowl didn't cover. He was tall, taller than me, 7 feet, and thin. His arms were folded, hands hidden inside the voluminous sleeves of his robe. Every eye in the place turned to the seventh member of the council, and a silence deeper than that of the nearby Great Lake enveloped the room. It lasted for long moments. Then the Merlin prompted quietly,
Gatekeeper, what say you?
I leaned forward in my chair, my mouth dry. If he voted against me, I was betting a warden would zap me unconscious before the sound of his voice died away. After several of my frantic heartbeats, the gatekeeper spoke in a resonant, gentle voice.
It rained toads this morning.
A baffled silence followed. It became, a moment later, a baffled mutter.
Gatekeeper, the Merlin said, his voice more urgent, how do you vote?
With deliberation, the gatekeeper said. It rained toads this morning. That bears consideration, and for that I must hear what word returns with the messenger. Lafortier eyed the gatekeeper and said impatiently, What message? What are you talking about? The back doors of the theater burst open, hard, and a pair of gray-cloaked wardens entered the theater. They each had a shoulder under one of the arms of a brown-robed young man. His face was puffy and swollen, and his hands looked like rotten sausages about to burst. Frost clung to his hair in a thick coating, and his robe looked like it had been dipped in water and then dragged behind a sled team from Anchorage to Nome. His lips were blue, and his eyes fluttered and rolled semi-coherently. The wardens dragged him to the foot of the stage, and the senior council gathered at his edge, looking down.
"This is my courier to the Winter Queen," Ancient Mai said.
"He insisted," one of the wardens said. We tried to take him for treatment, but he got so worked up about it I was afraid he would hurt himself, so we brought him to you, Ancient.
Where did you find him? The Merlin asked.
Outside. Someone drove up in a car and pushed him out of it. We didn't see who it was.
Did you get a license number? I asked. Both wardens turned an eye to me, then they turned back to the Merlin. Neither of them had gotten it. Maybe license plates were too new a concept. They weren't yet a whole century old, after all. Hell's bells, I muttered. I would have gotten it. Ancient Mai carefully descended from the stage and moved to the young man. She touched his forehead and spoke to him gently in what I presumed to be Chinese. The boy opened his eyes and babbled something broken and halting back at her. Ancient Mai frowned. She asked something else, which the boy struggled to answer, but it was apparently too much for him. He sagged, his eyes rolling back, and went completely limp. The ancient touched his hair and said in Latin, "Take him. Care for him." The wardens laid the boy on a cloak, and then four of them carried him out, moving quickly.
"What did he say?" Ebenezer asked. He beat me to it.
"He said that Queen Mab bade him to tell the council. She will permit them travel through her realm, provided one request is fulfilled."
The Merlin arched a brow, fingers touching his beard thoughtfully.
"What does she request?"
Ancient Mai murmured.
"She did not tell him. She only said she had already made her desires known to one of the council."
The senior council withdrew together to one side, speaking in low voices. I didn't pay them any mind. The ancient's translation of the messenger's words shocked me enough to keep me from so much as breathing, much less speaking. When I could move, I turned back to my table, leaning forward and banged my head gently on the wooden surface several times. "Damn it," I muttered in time with the bumps. "Damn it, damn it, damn it." A hand touched my shoulder, and I looked up to see the shadowed cowl of the gatekeeper standing apart from the rest of the senior council. His hand was covered by a black leather glove. I couldn't see any skin showing on him anywhere.
"You know what the Reign of Toads means," he said, his voice very quiet. His English had a gentle accent, something part Brit and part something else. "Indian? Middle Eastern?" I nodded.
"Trouble."
"Trouble?"
Though I could not see his face, I suspected a very slight smile had colored the word. The cowl turned toward the other senior council members, and he whispered,
"There isn't much time. Will you answer me one question honestly, Dresden?"
I checked Bluebeard to see if he was listening in. He had leaned way over toward the round-faced grandma-looking wizardress at the other table and appeared to be listening intently to her. I nodded to the gatekeeper. He waved his hands. No words, no pause to prepare, nothing. He waved a hand, and the sounds of the room suddenly seemed to blur together, robbed of any coherence at all.
"I understand you know how to listen, too. I would rather no one else heard us."
The sound of his voice came to me, warped parts, pitched high and others low, oddly reverberating. I gave him a wary nod.
"What is the question?"
He reached up to his cowl, black leather against twilight purple, and drew back the hood a little, enough so that I could see the gleam of one dark eye and a rough, thin, gray beard against bronzed skin. I couldn't see his other eye. His face seemed to ripple and contort in the shadows, and I had an idea that he was disfigured, maybe burned. In the socket of the missing eye, I saw something silver and reflective.
He leaned down closer and whispered near my ear, "Has Mab chosen an emissary?"
I struggled not to let the surprise show on my face, but I'm not always good at hiding my feelings. I saw comprehension flicker in the gatekeeper's shadowed eye.
Damn it. Now I understood why Mab had been so confident. She'd known all along that she had set me up for a deal I couldn't refuse. She'd done it without breaking our bargain either. Mab wanted me to take up her case, and she seemed perfectly happy to meddle in a supernatural war to get what she wanted. She'd just been toying with me in my office, and I'd fallen for it. I wanted to kick myself. Somewhere out there was a village I deprived of its idiot. In any case, there was no sense lying to the guy whose vote would decide my fate. I nodded to him.
"Yes." He shook his head.
"Precarious balance. The council could afford neither to keep you nor to cast you out."
"I don't understand."
"You will."
He drew the cowl back down and murmured, "I cannot prevent your fate, wizard. I can only give you a chance to avoid it on your own."
"What do you mean?"
"Cannot you see what is happening?"
I frowned at him. A dangerous imbalance of forces, a white council in town, Mab meddling in our affairs. Or perhaps we are meddling in hers. Why has she appointed a mortal emissary, young wizard? Because someone up there takes a malevolent amusement in my suffering? Balance, the gatekeeper corrected me. It's all about balance. Redress the imbalance, young wizard. Resolve the situation. Prove your worth beyond doubt. Are you telling me I should work for Mab? My voice sounded hollow, tinny, as though it was trapped in a coffee can. What is the date? The gatekeeper asked. June 18th, I said. Ah, of course. The gatekeeper turned away, and sounds returned to normal. The gatekeeper joined the rest of the senior council, and they trooped back to their podiums, podi, podia, whatever, goddamn correspondence course. Order, called the Merlin again, and the room grew quiet after a reluctant moment. Gatekeeper, the Merlin said, what is your vote? The figure of the gatekeeper silently lifted one hand. We have set our feet upon a darkling path, he murmured. A road that will only grow more dangerous. Our first steps are critical. We must make them with caution. The cowl turned toward Ebenezer, and the gatekeeper said, You love the boy, Wizard McCoy. You would fight to defend him. Your own dedication to our cause is not inconsiderable. I respect your choice. He turned to Lafortier. You question Dresden's loyalty and his ability. You imply that only a bad seed can grow from bad soil. Your concerns are understandable. And if correct, then Dresden poses a major threat to the council. He turned to Ancient Mai and inclined the cowl forward a few degrees. The Ancient responded with a slight bow of her own. Ancient Mai, the gatekeeper said, you question his ability to use his power wisely, to judge between right and wrong. You fear that De Morn's teaching may have twisted him in ways even he cannot yet see. Your fears, too, are justified. He turned to the Merlin. Honored Merlin, you know that Dresden has drawn death and danger down upon the council. You believe that if he is removed, so will be that danger. Your fears are understandable, but not reasonable. Regardless of what happens to Dresden, the Red Court has struck a blow against the council too deep to be ignored. A cessation of current hostilities would only be the calm before the storm.
Enough, man, Ebenezer demanded. Vote for or against.
I choose to base my vote upon a trial, a test that will lay to rest the fears of one side of the issue, or prove falsely placed the faith of the other.
What trial? The Merlin asked.
Mab, the gatekeeper said. Let Dresden address Queen Mab's request. Let him secure the assistance of Winter. If he does, that should lay to rest your concerns regarding his ability, Lafortier. Lafortier frowned, but then nodded at the gatekeeper. He turned next to Ancient Mai. Should he accomplish this, it would show that he is willing to accept responsibility for his mistake, and to work against his own best interests for the greater good of the council. It should satisfy your concerns as to his judgment. To make the mistakes of youth is no crime, but not to learn from them is. Agreed? Ancient Mai narrowed her rheumy eyes, but gave the gatekeeper a precise nod. And you, honored Merlin, such a success may do much to alleviate the pressure of the coming war. If securing routes through the Never-Never places the Red Court at a severe enough disadvantage, it may even enable us to avoid it completely. Surely it would prove Dresden's dedication to the council beyond a doubt.
That's all well and good, Ebenezer said. But what happens if he fails?
The gatekeeper shrugged. Then perhaps their fears are more justified than your affection, Wizard McCoy. We may indeed conclude that his appointment to full wizard initiate may have been premature.
All or nothing? Ebenezer demanded. Is that it? You expect the youngest wizard in the council to get the best of Queen Mab somehow? Mab! That's not a trial. It's a goddamned execution. How is he even supposed to know what a request was to begin with?
I stood up, my legs shaking a little. Ebenezer, I said,
How the hell is a boy supposed to know what she wants?
Ebenezer.
I'm not gonna stand by while you...
He abruptly blinked and looked at me. So did everyone else. I know what Mab wants, I said. She approached me earlier today, sir. She asked me to investigate something for her. I turned her down.
Hell's bells,
Ebenezer breathed. He took a blue bandana from his pocket and mopped at his gleaming forehead.
Hoss, this is out of your depth.
Looks like it's sink or swim, then, I said. The gatekeeper murmured to me in English, Will you accept this, Wizard Dresden? I nodded my head. My throat had gone dry. I swallowed and tried to remind myself that there wasn't much choice. If I didn't play with the fairies and come out on top, the council would serve me up to the vampires on a silver platter. The former might get me really, really killed. The latter would certainly kill me as well, and probably more than that. As deals went, it blew. But some little part of me that hadn't let me forget all the destruction, maybe even the deaths I'd caused last year, danced gleefully at my apparent comeuppance. Besides, it was the only game in town. I tightened my grip on my staff and spoke as clearly as I could manage.
Yeah, I accept.
Chapter 7. The rest of the council meeting was somewhat anticlimactic, for me, anyway. The Merlin ordered the wizards to disperse immediately after the meeting via pre-planned secure routes. He'd also distributed a list to everyone, noting the wardens near them to call upon if help was needed, and told them to check in with the wardens every few days as a safety precaution. Next, a grizzled old dame warden went over the theories to a couple of newly developed wards meant to work especially well against vampires. Representatives of the White Council's allies, secret occult brotherhoods mostly, each gave a brief speech declaring his or her group's support of the council in the war. Toward the end of the meeting, wardens showed up in force to escort wizards to the beginnings of their routes home. The senior council, I presumed, would loiter around for a few days in order to see if I got killed, trying to prove that I was one of the good guys. Sometimes I felt like no one appreciates me. I stood up 3 seconds before the Merlin said, "Meeting adjourned," and headed for the door. Ebenezer tried to catch my eye, but I didn't feel like talking to anyone. I slammed the doors open a little harder than I needed to, and stalked out to the Blue Beetle, and drove away with all the raging power the ancient four-cylinder engine could muster. Behold, the angry wizard putting away. My brain felt like something made out of stale cereal, coffee grounds, and cold pizza. Thoughts trudged around in aimless depression, mostly about how I was going to get myself killed playing private eye for Mab. If things got really bad, I might even drag down a few innocent bystanders with me. I growled at myself.
Stop whining, Harry, I said in a firm, loud voice. So what if you're tired? So what if you're hurt? So what if you smell like you're already dead? You're a wizard. You've got a job to do. This war is mostly your own fault, and if you don't stay on the ball, more people are going to get hurt. So stiff upper lip, chin up, whatever, get your ass in gear.
I nodded at that advice and glanced aside to the envelope Mab had given me, which lay on the passenger seat. I had a name, an address, a crime. I needed to get on the trail of the killer. That meant I would need information, and the people who would have the most information, a couple of days after the fact, would be the Chicago PD. I drove to Murphy's place. Lieutenant Karen Murphy was the head of Chicago PD's Special Investigations Team. SI was the city's answer to weirdness in general. They got all of the unusual crimes, the ones that didn't fall neatly into the department's other categories. SI had handled everything from sightings of sewer alligators to grave robbing in one of the city's many cemeteries. What fun. They also got to take care of the genuine supernatural stuff, the things no one talks about in official reports, but that managed to happen anyway. Trolls, vampires, demon-summoning sorcerers, you name it. The city had appointed SI to make sure the paperwork stayed nice and neat, with no mention of preposterous fantasies that could not possibly exist. It was a thankless job, and the directors of SI typically blew it after about a month by refusing to believe they were dealing with genuine weirdness.
and they got shuffled out of Chicago PD. Murphy hadn't. She'd lasted. She'd taken things seriously and employed the services of Chicago's only professional wizard, guess who, as a consultant on the tougher jobs. Murphy and I have seen some very upsetting things together. We're friends. She would help. Murphy lives in a house in Bucktown, near a lot of other cops. It's a tiny place, but she owns it. Grandma Murphy left it to her. The house is surrounded by a neat little lawn. I pulled up in the Beetle sometime well after summertime dark, but before midnight. I knew she'd be home, though I wasn't certain she'd be awake. I made sure that I didn't sound like I was trying to sneak up anywhere. I shut the door of the Beetle hard and walked with firm footsteps to her door, then knocked lightly. A moment later, the curtains on the barred windows beside the door twitched and then fell back into place. A lock disengaged, then another, then a door chain. I noted as I waited that Murphy had a steel-reinforced door just like I did, though I doubted she'd had as many demons or assassins showing up at it. Murphy opened the door part way and peered out at me. The woman didn't look like the chief of Chicago PD's monster hunters. Her bright blue eyes were heavy, weary, and underscored with dark bags. She stood 5 feet nothing in her bare feet. Her golden hair was longer on top than in back, with bangs hanging down to her eyes. She wore a pale peach terry cloth bathrobe that fell most of the way to her feet. In her right hand she held her automatic, and a small crucifix dangling on a chain wrapped around her wrist. She looked at me. "Hey, Murph," I said. I looked at the gun and the holy symbol and kept my voice calm. "Sorry to drop in on you this late. I need your help." Murphy regarded me in silence for more than a minute. Then she said, "Wait here." She shut the door, returned a minute later, and opened it up again all the way. Then, gun still in hand, she stepped back from the doorway and faced me. I said, "Murph, are you all right?" She nodded. "Okay," I said. "Can I come in?" "We'll know in a minute," Murphy said. I got it then. Murphy wasn't going to ask me in. There are plenty of monsters running around in the dark that can't violate the threshold of a home if they aren't invited in. One of them had caught up to Murphy last year, nearly killing her, and it had been wearing my face when it did. No wonder she didn't look exactly overjoyed to see me. "Murph," I said, "relax, it's me. Hell's bells, there isn't anything I can think of that would mimic me looking like this. Even demonic fiends from the nether regions of hell have some taste." I stepped across her threshold. Something tugged at me as I did, an intangible, invisible energy. It slowed me down a little, and I had to make an effort to push through it. That's what a threshold is like. One like it surrounds every home, a field of energy that keeps out unwanted magical forces. Some places have more of a threshold than others. My apartment, for example, didn't have much of a threshold. It's a bachelor pad, and whatever domestic energy is responsible for such things doesn't seem to settle down as well in rental spaces and lone dwellings. Murphy's house had a heavy field surrounding it. It had a life of its own. It had history. It was a home, not just a place to live. I crossed her threshold uninvited, and I left a lot of my power at the door as I did. I would have to really push to make even the simplest of spells work within. I stepped inside and spread my hands. "Do I pass inspection?" Murphy didn't say anything. She crossed the room and put her gun back into its holster, setting it down on an end table. Murphy's place was, dare I say, cute. The room was done in soft yellows and greens. There were ruffles. The curtains had ruffles. And the couch had more. Plus those little knitted things. Aren't they called doilies? Were draped over the arms of two of the recliners, the couch, the coffee table, and just about every other surface that seemed capable of supporting lacy bits of frou-fra. They looked old and beautiful and well cared for. I was betting Murphy's grandma had picked them out. Murphy's own decorating was limited to the gun cleaning kit sitting on the end table beside the holster for her automatic and a wooden rack over the fireplace that bore a pair of Japanese swords, long and short, one over the other. That was the Murphy I knew and loved. Practical, violence ready at hand. Next to the swords was a small row of photographs in holders, maybe her family.
A thick picture album with what looked like a real leather cover sat open on the coffee table next to a prescription bottle and a decanter of some kind of liquor. Gin. The decanter was half empty. The glass next to it was completely empty. I watched her settle down in the corner of the couch in her oversized bathrobe, her expression remote. She didn't look at me. I got more worried by the moment. Murphy wasn't acting like Murphy. She'd never passed up a chance to trade banter with me. I'd never seen her this silent and withdrawn. Damn it, just when I needed some quick and decisive help. Something was wrong with Murphy, and I hardly had time to play dime store psychologist trying to help her. I needed whatever information she could get me. I also needed to help her with whatever it was that had hurt her so badly. I was fairly sure I wouldn't be able to do either if I didn't get her talking. "Nice place, Murph," I told her. "I haven't seen it before." She twitched one shoulder in what might have been a shrug. I frowned.
You know, if conversation is too much for you, we could play charades. I'll go first. I held up my hand with my fingers spread. Murphy didn't say anything, so I provided her into the dialogue.
5 words, I tugged on my ear.
Sounds like, what is wrong with you?
She shook her head. I saw her eyes flicker toward the album. I leaned forward and turned the album towards me. It had been opened on a cluster of wedding pictures. The girl in them must have been Murphy back when. She had longer, sunnier hair and a kind of adolescent slenderness that showed around her neck and wrists. She wore a white wedding gown and stood next to a tuxedo-clad man who had to have been 10 years older than she was. In other pictures, she was shoving cake into his mouth, drinking through linked arms, the usual wedding fare. He had carried her to the getaway car, and the photo Murphy's face had been caught in a moment of laughter and joy.
First husband? I asked.
That got through to her. She glanced up at me for a second, then nodded.
You're a kid in this. Maybe 18?
She shook her head.
17?
She nodded. At least I was getting some kind of response out of her.
How long were you married to him?
Silence. I frowned.
Murph, I'm not like a genius about this stuff or anything, but if you're feeling guilty about something, maybe you're being a little hard on yourself.
Without a word, she leaned forward and picked up the album, moving it aside to reveal a copy of the Tribune. It had been folded open to the obituaries page. She picked it up and handed it to me. I read the first one out loud. Gregory Taggart, age 43, died last night after a long bout with cancer. I paused and looked at the photograph of the deceased and then at Murphy's album. It was the same man, give or take several years of wear and tear. I winced and lowered the paper. Oh, God, Murph, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. She blinked her eyes several times. Her voice came out thready, quiet.
He didn't even tell me that he was sick.
Talk about your nasty surprises. Murph, look, I'm sure that things will work out. I know how you're hurting, how you must feel, but...
Do you? She said, still very quiet. Do you know how I feel? Did you lose your first love?
I sat quietly for a full minute before I said, Yeah, I did.
What was her name?
It hurt to think the name, much less say it. But if it helped me get through to Murphy, I couldn't afford to be touchy. Elaine, we were... both of us were orphans. We got adopted by the same man when we were 10. Murphy blinked and looked up at me.
She was your sister?
I don't have any relatives. We were both adopted by the same guy, that's all. We lived together, drove one another nuts... Puberty hit together. Do the math. She nodded.
How long were you together?
Oh, until we were about 16.
What happened? How did she...
I shrugged. My adoptive father tried to get me into black magic, human sacrifice. Murphy frowned.
He was a wizard?
I nodded. Strong one. So was she.
Didn't he try to get Elaine, too?
Did get her, I said.
She was helping him.
What happened? She asked quietly. I tried to keep my voice even and calm, but I wasn't sure how well I managed it. I ran away. He sent a demon after me. I beat it
and then went back to save Elaine. She hit me with a binding spell when I wasn't looking, and he tried a spell that would break into my mind, make me do what he wanted. I slipped out of the spell Elaine had on me and took on Justin. I got lucky. He lost. Everything burned. Murphy swallowed. What happened to Elaine? Burned, I said quietly, my throat tightening. She's dead. God, Harry. Murphy was quiet for a moment. Greg left me. We tried to talk a few times, but it always ended in a fight. Her eyes welled up with tears. Damn it. I should have at least gotten to tell him goodbye. I put the paper back on the table and closed the album, studiously not looking at Murphy. I knew she wouldn't want me to see her crying. She inhaled sharply. I'm sorry, Harry, she said. I'm flaking out on you here. I shouldn't. I don't know why this is getting to me so hard. I glanced at the booze and the pills on the table. It's okay. Everyone has an off day sometimes. I can't afford it. She drew the bathrobe a little closer around herself and said, Sorry, Harry, about the gun. Her words sounded heavy, maybe a little slurred. I had to be sure it was really you. I understand, I said. She looked at me, and something like gratitude touched her eyes. She got up from the couch abruptly and walked down the hallway out of the living room and said over her shoulder, Let me put something else on. Sure, okay, I said after her, frowning. I leaned over to the table and picked up the prescription bottle behind the booze, next to the empty tumbler, a medium-sized dose of Valium. No wonder Murphy had been slurring her words, Valium and gin. Hell's bells. I was still holding the pills when she came back in, wearing baggy shorts and a T-shirt. She'd raked a brush through her hair and splashed water on her face, so I couldn't tell that she'd been crying. She stopped short and looked at me. I didn't say anything. She chewed on her lip. Murph, I said finally. Are you okay? Do you need... Relax, Dresden, she said, folding her arms. I'm not suicidal. Funny you say that. Mixing drinks with drugs is a great way to get it done. She walked over to me, jerked the pill bottle out of my hands, and picked up the bottle of booze. This isn't any of your business, she said. She walked into the kitchen, dropped things off, and came back out again. I'm fine. I'll be fine. Murph, I've never seen you with a drink in your life, and Valium? It makes me worry about you. Dresden, if you came over here to lecture me, you can leave right now. I shoved my fingers through my shaggy hair. Karen, I swear I'm not lecturing. I'm just trying to understand. She looked away from me for a minute, one foot rubbing against the opposite calf. It hit me how small she looked, how frail. Her eyes were not only weary, I saw now. They were haunted. I looked over to her and put a hand on her shoulder. Her skin was warm beneath the cotton of her T-shirt. Talk to me, Murph, please. She pulled her shoulder out from under my hand. It isn't a big deal. It's the only way I can get any sleep. What do you mean? She took a deep breath. I mean I can't sleep without help. The drinks didn't help. The drugs didn't either. I have to use both or I won't get any rest. I still don't get it. Why can't you sleep? Is it because of Greg? Murphy shook her head and moved over to the couch, away from me, and curled up in the corner of it, clasping her hands over her knees. I've been having nightmares. Night terrors, the doctors say. They say it's different from just bad dreams. I felt my cheek twitch with tension. And you can't stay asleep? She shook her head. I wake myself up screaming. I saw her clench her fists. God damn it, Dresden. There's no reason for it. I shouldn't get rattled by a few bad dreams. I shouldn't fall to pieces hearing about a man I haven't spoken to in years. I don't know what the fuck is wrong with me. I closed my eyes. You're dreaming about last year, aren't you? About what Kravos did to you. She shivered at the mention of the name and nodded. I couldn't stop thinking about it for a long time, trying to figure out what I did wrong. Why was he able to get to me? I ached inside. Murph, there wasn't anything you could have done. Don't you think I know that? She said, her voice quiet. I couldn't have known it wasn't you. I couldn't have stopped him even if I had. I couldn't have done anything to defend myself. To stop
what he did to me. Once he was inside my head. Her eyes clouded with tears, and she blinked them away, her jaw setting. There wasn't anything I could have done. That's what scares me, Harry. That's why I'm afraid.
Murph, he's dead. He's dead and gone. We watched them put him in the ground.
Murphy snarled. I know that. I know it, Harry. I know he's gone. I know he can't hurt me anymore. I know he's never going to hurt anyone again.
She looked up at me for a moment, chancing a look at my eyes. Hers were clouded with tears.
But I still have the dreams. I know it, but it doesn't make any difference. God, poor Murphy. She'd taken a spiritual mauling before I'd shown up to save her. The thing that attacked her had been a spirit being, and it had torn her apart on the inside without leaving a mark on her skin. In a way, she'd been raped. All of her power had been taken away, and she'd been used for the amusement of another. No wonder it had left her with scars. Adding an unpleasant shock of bad news had been like tossing a spark onto a pile of tinder soaked with jet fuel. Harry, she continued, her voice quiet and soft. You know me. God, I'm not a whiner. I hate that. But what that thing did to me, the things it made me see, made me feel.
She looked up at me, pain in the lines at the corners of her eyes, which threatened tears.
It won't go away. I try to leave it behind, but it won't go. And it's eating up every part of my life.
She turned away, grabbing irritably at a box of tissues. I walked over to the fireplace and studied the swords on the mantel so she wouldn't feel my eyes on her. After a moment she spoke, her tone changing, growing more focused.
What are you doing here so late?
I turned back to face her. I need a favor. Information. I passed over the envelope Mad had given me. Murphy opened it, looked at the pair of pictures, and frowned.
These are shots from the report of Ronald Rule's death. How did you get them?
I didn't, I said. A client gave them to me. I don't know where she got them. She rubbed her eyes and asked,
What did she want from you?
She wants me to find the person who killed him. Murphy shook her head.
Well, I thought this was an accidental death.
I hear it isn't.
Where'd you hear that?
I sighed. A magical fairy told me. That got me a suspicious glare, which dissolved into a frown.
God, you're being literal, aren't you?
Yeah. Murphy shook her head, a tired smile at the corners of her mouth.
How can I help?
Well, I'd like to look at the file on Ronald Rule's death. I can't look at the scene, but maybe CPD caught something they didn't know was a clue. It would give me a place to start, at least. Murphy nodded without looking at me.
All right. One condition.
Sure. What?
If this is a murder, you bring me in on it.
Murph, I protested. Come on, I don't want to pull you into anything that...
Damn it, Harry, Murphy snapped. If someone's killing people in Chicago, I'm going to deal with it. It's my job. What's been happening to me doesn't change that.
It's your job to stop the bad guys, I said. But this might not be a guy. Maybe not even human. I just think you'd be safer if...
Fuck safe, Murphy muttered.
My job, Harry. If you turn up a killing, you will bring me in. I hesitated, trying not to let my frustration show. I didn't want Murphy involved with Mab and company. Murphy had earned too many scars already. The fairies had a way of insinuating themselves into your life. I didn't want Murphy exposed to that, especially as vulnerable as she was. But at the same time, I couldn't lie to her. I owed her a lot more than that. Bottom line, Murphy had been hurt. She was afraid, and if she didn't force herself to face that fear, it might swallow her whole. She knew it. As terrified as she was, she knew she had to keep going, or she would never recover. As much as I wanted to keep her safe, especially now, it wouldn't help her. Not in the long run. In a sense, her life was at stake. Deal, I said quietly. She nodded and rose.
Stay out here. I need to get on the computer, see what I can pull up for you.
I can wait if it's better. She shook her head.
I've already taken the Valium. If I wait any longer, I'll be too zonked to think straight. Just sit down, have a drink. Try not to blow up anything.
She padded out of the room on silent feet. I sat down in one of the armchairs, stretched my legs,
let my head fall forward, and dropped into a light doze. It had been a long day, and it looked like it was just going to get longer. I woke up when Murphy came back into the room, her eyes heavy. She had a manila folder with her. "Okay," she said. "This is everything I could print out. The pictures aren't as clear as they could be, but they aren't horrible." I sat up, took the folder from her, and opened it. Murphy sat down in an armchair facing me, her legs tucked beneath her. I started going over the details in the folder, though my brain felt like some sort of gelatin dessert topped with mush. "What happened to your hand?" she asked. "Magic fairy," I said. "Magic fairy with a letter opener." "It doesn't look good. The dressing isn't right either. You should have someone look at it." I shook my head. "Not time." "Harry, you idiot." She got up, disappeared into the kitchen, and came back out with a first aid kit. I decided not to argue with her. She pulled up a chair from the kitchen, next to mine, and rested my arm in her lap. "I'm trying to read here, Murph." "You're still bleeding. Puncture wounds will ooze forever if you don't keep them covered." "Yeah, I tried to explain that, but they made me take the bandage off anyway."
"Who did?"
"Long story. So the security guard on the building didn't see anyone who came in?" She peeled off the bandage with brisk motions. It hurt. She fished out some disinfectant. "Cameras didn't pick up anything either, and there aren't any bursts of static to indicate someone using magic. I checked." I whistled. "Not bad, Murph." "Yeah, sometimes I use my head instead of my gun. This'll hurt." She sprayed disinfectant liberally on my hand. It stung.
"Ow!
Wimp. Any other ways in or out of the building?" "Not unless they could fly and walk through walls. The other doors are all fire exits, with alarms that would trip if someone opened them." I kept paging through the file. "Broken neck due to fall," it says. "They found him at the bottom of the stairs." "Right." Murphy used a wipe to clean both sides of my hand, and then she put more disinfectant on. It hurt a bit less. "He had contusions consistent with a fall, and he was an old man. No one seen entering or leaving the apartment building with a high security system, so naturally, no one looked for a killer," I finished. "Or reported anything that might have indicated one." "Or wait, did they? It says here that the first officer on the scene found slippery goo on the landing above where Rule fell." "But none of the detectives on the scene later found any such thing," Murphy said. She pressed a gauze pad against the wound from either side and began wrapping medical tape around to hold the pads on. "The first officer was a rookie. They figured he was seeing a killing where there wasn't one so he could get on a murder investigation." I frowned, turning the printouts of the photographs around. "See here? The sleeves of Rule's coat are wet. You can see the discoloration." She looked and admitted, "Maybe. There's no mention of it, though. Slippery goo. It could have been ectoplasm." "Is that too tight? Ecto what?" I flexed my fingers a little, testing the bandage. "It's fine. Ectoplasm. Matter from the Never Never. That's the spirit world, right? Fairyland? Among other things. And that stuff from there is goo? It turns to goo when there's not any magic animating it. As long as the magic is there, it's as good as real. Like when Kravos made a body that looked like mine and came gunning for you." Murphy shivered and started putting things back into her kit. "So when whatever it is that made this ecto-goo into matter is gone, it turns back into slime," I said. "It's clear and slippery, and it evaporates in a few minutes." "So something from the Never Never could have killed Rule?" Murphy said. "Yeah," I said. "Or someone could have opened up a portal into the apartment building. There's usually some gunk left when you open a portal. Dust drifting out from the Never Never. So they could have opened a portal, then gotten out the same way." "Whoa, hold it. I thought Fairyland was monsters only. People can go into the Never Never?"
"If you know the right magic, yeah. It's full of things that are fairly dangerous, though. You don't just cruise through on a Sunday stroll."
"Jesus Christ," Murphy muttered. "So someone, or something," I interjected, "or something, could have gotten into the building and out again. Just like that. Past all the locks and guards and cameras. How scary is that?"
"It could have, yeah. Stepped in, pitched Grandpa down the stairs, stepped out again."
"God, that poor old man."
"I don't think he was helpless, Murph. Rule was mixed up with fairies. I kind of doubt his hands were squeaky clean." She nodded.
"Okay. Had he made any supernatural enemies?"
I held up the picture of the body.
"Looks like it."
Merv shook her head. She swayed a little bit and then sat down next to me, leaning her head against the corner of the couch. So what's the next step?
I go digging. Pound the proverbial pavement.
You don't look so good. Get some rest first, a shower, some food, maybe a...